Campus 7 presents a talk organised by the Archaeological Society entitled North Africa in Later Antiquity by Monsignor George Mifsud Montanaro.
Good evening, members and non-members, to this gathering this evening. I don't know what number this is in our number of talks, but I think we've had about six this season already, or five. About halfway through. This evening, we have as our speaker, Monsignor George Mifsud Montanaro. Just a few words of introduction. Monsignor Mifsud Montanaro spent many years in Rome and is a scholar of considerable repute here in Malta and also abroad. An historian and respected researcher, he has written on many subjects, including the Knights of St. John, and is particularly interested in the history of the Eastern Church. He was a founder member of the Malta Historical Society and some years ago was given honorary life membership by the society. He was recently appointed on a research ethics committee representing the Mediterranean Institute, where he's a member of the board. A familiar figure here in Malta's capital, Monsignor Mifsud Montanaro is known by many, not least because of his teaching career.
Well, first of all, I have to be very apologetic because I am somewhat awed by the audience. There are specialists among the audience and I am far from being a specialist at all. My training, it is true, has been historical, but my my dissertation was on a 14th century figure and bishop of Rochester, so very far from the subject we are dealing with today. I gave way to a certain insistence, otherwise I would never have dared to speak on this subject, which is a complex subject. On the other hand, North Africa does interest me. I have lived in and served the church in North Africa, 4 years in Morocco, and I had a rapid journey all along the coast of North Africa, and I spent about 3 weeks in Libya very many years ago. But I'm interested because I'm interested in the people of these countries, and I'm also interested in the history of the church. The subject, as announced, was North Africa in late antiquity. Late antiquity is a term which has been invented in recent years, within the last 20, 30 perhaps years. You have a number of works by, it has been popularized among others by Peter Brown, as you know, who has entitled some of his works as Late Antiquity. In French, the period is very often designated as le bas empire, the late empire, the low empire, the late empire. My theme today really was announced as North Africa in late antiquity and a very brief survey. And it cannot but be a brief survey. But in order to understand this period at all, you have to go back. First of all, what do we mean by late antiquity? This is a very vague term, first of all. But it is taken to refer to the Christian Roman Empire, that is to say, from Constantine on, perhaps up to Justinian, perhaps up to Heraclius and the Arab invasions, and then The normal practice is to refer simply to the Byzantine Empire and the barbarian kingdoms in the West and the Caliphate in the Near East and North Africa, with the various derivations of both Caliphate and barbarian kingdoms, and also Byzantine Empire. So I will begin by referring to the period of Constantine, first of all, and with special reference to Africa. First of all, there is a great something very important to keep in mind all the time, and that is to say, when you say North Africa, you generally exclude Egypt, because Egypt has its own very peculiar tradition and history, which makes it very different from areas west of what we know as Egypt. So you can what is referred to today as the Maghreb, which means the west for a Near Easterner, for an Arab of Saudi, Maghreb is anything from Libya on. But in the past, it was not quite that exactly, because you have Cyrenaica, and then Tripolitania, and then you have the other western provinces. Cyrenaica, within the period between Constantine and the Arab invasions, Cyrenaica has its own particular physiognomy. First of all, you have a linguistic divide from the official point of view, the point of view of government. You have Cyrenaica, which is Greek, and Tripolitania, Byzacena, Proconsularis, Numidia, and the two Mauritanias are Latin as regards official diction. That is to say, the government is Latin. In Cyrenaica, the government uses Greek just as it uses, I'm speaking about the Roman government. Egypt and Cyrenaica, the language is Greek, official language. Now, within these areas, you have the indigenous languages. In Egypt, you have the Coptic language. Alexandria is a completely Hellenized city, but the hinterland is Coptic-speaking. You have a lot of people who speak both Greek and Coptic. And it is only with the religious divisions that Coptic becomes a national language until Arabic absorbs the linguistic field. Cyrenaica equally is Greek-speaking, but unlike Egypt, Cyrenaica has a Greek background and a Greek origin. Cyrenaica, the urbanized, if not civilized parts, were the descendants, the development of Greek colonization. As you know, in the early period of great colonizing period, that is to say, Phoenician navigation begins around about the 12th century BC. From the 7th century BC, it becomes rather systematic, and not only are trading posts established, but cities are planted with their own constitutions. From the 7th century, you have Greek and Phoenician colonies being established along the shores of the Mediterranean, especially in North Africa, Spain, and in wherever possible. The Greeks had many colonies in Italy, Sicily was Hellenized to a very great extent, although in Sicily you have a rivalry developing between Phoenician colonies and Greek colonies, and the Phoenician, the Punic element trying to absorb and conquer the Greek elements, but they were prevented because of the very energetic resistance of Dionysius the Great, the tyrant of Syracuse and later Timoleon, so that they came to a modus vivendi, and eastern Sicily was very definitely Greek, and in the eastern parts you had Punic established. Now, this same sort of rivalry between Greek and Phoenician also took place in North Africa and in Spain, of course. There is no Phoenician colony in what is today France, the Gaul, but there were very important Greek colonies. there was an attempt by Carthage to conquer Cyrenaica, but it failed. The local Greek population resisted and maintained their independence. Now, Cyrenaica is also known as the Pentapolis. Pentapolis means the five cities, because the five main cities in that region formed a kind of confederation of cities, each city with its own constitution, but federated, so that they could collaborate, particularly in military operations and also in commercial and diplomatic relations. Now, Cyrenaica develops along its own lines. Until Constantine, it maintained a very strong Greek character. And even after Constantine, and right up to the to Justinian, it certainly keeps its Greek character. So Cyrenaica has its own particular physiognomy, which distinguishes it from the rest of the Maghreb. Tripolitania and Byzacena, Tunis, what is today Tunis, Byzacena is the southern part, and Proconsularis, another Roman province, is the northern part, with Carthage as its capital, and Numidia, and the Mauritanians. They observed, as I said, they followed the Roman practice, so that all literature produced between, from the beginning of Roman rule, which is the 3rd century BC, to the Arab invasions, is in the Latin language. Now, if we take our as our start in Latin, late empire, the advent of Constantine and the advent with Constantine of Christianity, here we have a very important event happening, because it is not only a new government simply succeeding to a previous government. After all, Constantine is an emperor succeeding to a previous emperor, succeeding Diocletian, Diocletian who divided the empire into four parts, creating a tetrarchy. Constantine is still an heir of the Roman Empire. But his advent does imply, does involve a great change in civilization, in mental outlook, in spirit, And what we observe in this period, Constantine to the Arab invasions, is a change of civilization, a change of mental outlook. And that is why this period is extremely important, and also, I may say, rather difficult to follow, because you can say that every important personage merits a lifetime study. You have in this period an evolution within paganism. You have a number of religious cults which flourish at the period. Paganism is, as you know, a very complex phenomenon. And this period does reveal much evolution in the attitude to divinity, the supernatural, so that you have various manifestations and various expressions of pagan cult. You have the popular religion, folk religion, which is very close to the earth and to the local divinities. And you have the great cults being assimilated one to another, so that you have an identification of Jupiter and Zeus and Baal Hamon in Carthage, who receives in Carthage a new name, Celestis, etc., and Tanit, who is the face of Baal, is made equal with the mother of the gods, Juno. What you notice in North Africa and throughout the world, in the late empire, is a general tendency towards monotheism. And this probably did help Christianity to spread, especially in North Africa. In North Africa, Christianity spread very rapidly. A very interesting problem, which is a new problem, a new subject of research, has been the attempt to explain the origins of African Christianity. A lot of work has been done, and one of the main promoters of this subject is a person who has written almost about everything, but he did write two very important, at least a trilogy, which is very important, and that is Cardinal Danielou, who has written on the Judeo-Christian tradition and on the relations of Christianity with classical culture, and with the beginnings of Latin Christianity and Christian Latin literature. He's only one among many scholars. Danielou had great ideas, but great ideas which need to be supported by particular research, and this is what is necessary today. But as regards the origins of African Christianity, there is a general consensus among scholars today that its origin, and this is in itself not very surprising, not in the least surprising, that the earliest Christianity in North Africa is naturally through Judaism. The earliest Christian missions were among the Jews, and the Jews were an international community who traveled quite a lot to Jerusalem, from Jerusalem to all parts of the Ecumene, and it is agreed among scholars today that Christianity almost certainly, although there are no material records, that Christianity was already represented in North Africa by the end of the first century, contemporaneously with Rome, perhaps also with Malta. And this and that the first Christian communities were of a Judeo-Christian type, that is, made up of Jews who accepted Christianity. There were also other adepts of Christianity who joined this community, Jews who believed in Christ, Judeo-Christian communities, but who conformed to the Judeo-Christian outlook. Cardinal Danielou gives a number of examples of from early Christian literature, first century, particularly with reference to a very famous document which is known as the Didache, the Doctrine of the 12 Apostles, which is a Judeo-Christian document in the form in which it is known to us. It is a Judeo-Christian document, but which makes use, adapts, and amplifies an earlier Jewish document. On the two ways, one way which leads to salvation, and one has to choose between the two ways. And this particular part, which is found in the Didache, which is the ethical teaching of this doctrine, is found in a purely Jewish document of earlier date, naturally. But this is one of the documents which represent the Judeo-Christian community of the early period, post New Testament, that is, sub-apostolic period. You have a number of other documents, Epistle of Barnabas, which is not in the New Testament canon, but it is considered as a work of that group of writers who are known as the Apostolic Fathers. They belong to the sub-apostolic community, Christian community, and a number of other documents. These documents were well known both in Rome and in Carthage in Africa. And Africa, as you know, Rome, the language of the people was traditional language of the people in Rome was Latin, but the majority of people living in Rome spoke Greek, and Greek was the current language, so that in the Christian communities in Rome, Greek was the language of prayer, just as Greek is the language of the Christian scriptures, the New Testament. So the language of the liturgy in Rome was Greek until the end of the second century, and Greek went on being the official language in Rome until the fourth. In Africa, Greek was not very well known in North Africa, not in Cyrenaica, but outside of Cyrenaica. Latin was better known. Punic was spoken generally. Berber in the interior also. But there are no Berber. There is no Berber literature. There are a few Berber inscriptions. And there are also Punic inscriptions of this period, but there is no literature. Old Punic literature disappeared with the destruction of Carthage in the 3rd century BC. So that in Africa, the scriptures, both Old Testament and New Testament, were very early translated into Latin, before even Rome. And in addition to the scriptures, you have a number of works produced in North Africa which are of a type which is classified today as Judeo-Christian because of the predominance of apocalyptic, because of a rather dramatic vision of life, a heroic vision of life conditioned by Jews were often persecuted, the Maccabees, the second book of Maccabees, a number of apocryphal books, 4th and 5th, Esdras, etc., were produced by the Jews, and these exalted the idea of resistance to a persecutor and exalted the figure of the martyr. These are all elements which are to be found in these documents belonging and produced by the Judeo-Christian community. And these had very great currency in North Africa, more than in Rome, especially the apocalyptic and the heroic martyr sort of spirituality. And these are characteristics which continue to mark the people of North Africa, that is North African Christianity, the cult of the martyrs, for example, a manner of interpreting history as an opposition, a war between good forces and evil forces, so that you have in North Africa in particular, even with a great author like Tertullian, for example, a depiction of anything Roman, anything empire, as being quite evil and completely incompatible with Christianity. This very strong opposition of black and white and good and evil. This is typical of North Africa, an extremist attitude. Now, African Christianity, as I said, is believed to have to be the product of Jewish elements and of an original community of Jews. Christians in North Africa, Tertullian tells us, that they were known as the Nazareni, and that is where our Maltese Nisrani comes from. A lot of discussion has gone on about what is the origin of this word. Nisrani is not normally used in the Near East by Christians. They don't call themselves Nisrani. They call themselves Masihi, Christian, Messianic. But the normal designation given by Arabs and in the Quran is Nisrani. Now, where did this terminology originate? It is not very clear. It was used in the East by both Orthodox Judeo-Christian communities and heterodox, that is, heretical or non-Christian. But it was certainly used in North Africa a long time before direct Arab influence occurred. And this is very, very interesting. Now, the first attitude of the Christians was therefore to inspire themselves on the Jewish models. And this is what occurred in North Africa. You have even more than Rome, and for a longer period, you have a multiplication of small community heads and an organization, church organization, which is based on bishops, but also with a very strong representation of elders, 70 elders, which is a continuation of synagogue practice. The first documentary reference to Christianity in North Africa occurs in 180 AD, when a group of martyrs from a place called Shilla were martyred. And we have the Acts, which are authentic reportage of the trial and martyrdom of these martyrs. The place has not been identified, but they were brought to Carthage, and the Acta were drawn up in Carthage, and in Carthage they had a very great cult. Now, that is the first documentary evidence, but of course that does not mean that Christianity was not present before. From this point of view, I think we have always got to be very, very cautious in judging on our past history, both in Africa and in Malta, because the fact that there is no documentary evidence does not mean that a certain reality has not already occurred. What we have to say is that there is simply no documentary evidence that a Christian presence in Malta, I give only an example, is possible, but there is no evidence, particular evidence for it. Now, the Jewish community and the Christian community were considered really as almost a single entity. From the point of view of the Roman government, from the point of view of the ordinary layman in the period, 1st, 2nd, 3rd century, Jews and Christians were hardly different from one another. They used the same scriptures. They had connections with each other. They had the same origin because they both referred to somebody who lived in Jerusalem. And in fact, Christianity first appears as a Jewish sect. And the two communities, Jewish and Christian, were so closely related that you have in North Africa, at least in two cases, two necropolis, two catacombs in a place not very far from Carthage and a place in Adrumetum, which is present-day Sousse. You have a Jewish necropolis in which there are also Christian tombs, so probably members of the same family, or if not members, but certainly neighbors and closely related. So you have a very close interrelationship between Christians and Jews in North Africa. Between Christians and Jews, there is a lot of rivalry. For an outsider, they seem to be two very similar sects, but between Christians and Jews, between the church and the synagogue, there is great rivalry. Both communities are proselytizing communities. And you have, in a very early period, you have Christians, Judeo-Christian polemics flourishing. And you have the production on the Christian side of a great number of texts which represent responses to Jewish criticism. A number of tracts which bear the name of Adversus Judaeus, which is a response to to a polemic, to criticism from the other side, Christian apologetic directed to the Jews. One of the most famous is the dialogue of Justin Martyr with Tryphon. Now, this is a work which was produced in Rome. Justin was himself from Neapolis in Palestine, that is Nablus, but he wrote in Rome and he was martyred in the East. And Tertullian, who wrote round about the year 200 in his Apologeticum and his work, and in another work which is was formerly attributed to Tertullian, Adversus Judaeos, makes use of Justin. And you have texts known as Testimonia, which bring up passages from the Old Testament which prove the realization of the prophecies in Christ, etc. Texts used precisely in Judeo-Christian polemic or dialogue, or in any case, apologetic works. A great number of these have survived from the African church, the Church of Carthage. The first, by the time Tertullian is writing, and that is between 190 and 220, from being an obscure sect, Tertullian begins to say that, look at us, Christians, we are everywhere. We are all over the world, in the army, in the amphitheater, and so on. So what has happened? During the second century, obviously, there has been a great spread of Christianity. And this Christianity was not yet a Christianity which was able to present an external face in the way of building structures. The early Christian worship was carried out in private houses or in houses which were semi-private, that is to say, were used principally for the clergy and for communal worship, but did not have any distinctive external structure or facade to distinguish them from ordinary dwellings. In the third century, you have again very great and very rapid spread of Christianity throughout North Africa. The spread of Christianity was not an easy matter because you had rival religious systems competing. Tertullian himself was a convert to Christianity, a jurist and a rhetorician who had studied in Carthage, studied in Rome, practiced in Rome, returned to Carthage, and a man of very great culture who was completely bilingual, wrote in Greek to start with, but then wrote in Latin, a very good stylist, and not only is he a very good pleader and apologete for Christianity, as a lawyer he exploits his legal training in pleading for Christianity, but he is also a philosopher, very strongly influenced by Stoicism. Tertullian himself moves from paganism to mainstream Christianity and then ends up a Montanist, that is, belonging to a heterodox sect, and finally also breaks with the Montanists and sets up his own community. So this is typical of the situation in the third century with competing religious systems. Now, among the competing religious systems, you had Gnosticism, strong also in the West, both in Africa and in Gaul. The great writers of the period are in Gaul and in Africa. Africa has far greater writers than either Rome or, except for Irenaeus in Gaul, of course. So Gnosticism, a derivation of Neoplatonism, but with its own mythology to explain most of these systems, whether they were Gnosticism or later Manichaeism, which enters also, they were attempts at explaining the human the human condition and the origin of evil and the origin of things. Another competing religious system, philosophical religious system, was Neoplatonism, and another was Manichaeism, and you had other movements, Martianism. The atmosphere in North Africa was one of religious search, and what characterizes North Africa is the passion that goes into it, the intensity, and to a certain extent the fanaticism that goes with it. Augustine is an example, because Augustine, as we know, went through different stages. He was of a Christian background. His mother was a very fervent Christian. He came from the small provincial nobility. He had a classical education, which he perfected in the schools of rhetoric in Carthage. And it was in Carthage that, tormented by the problem of evil and of liberation, salvation, if you like, that he became a Manichae. And he became a Manichae until he was disillusioned by it, because he did not find the answers that he had been promised. Manichaeism is a religion which was founded in the Persian Empire in the 2nd century AD by a self-proclaimed prophet, Mani, who called himself Apostle of Jesus Christ and who claimed to be himself the Paraclete, and who, to explain the origin of evil, posited the existence of two absolute powers, divinities, a god of good, an absolute principle of good, and an absolute principle of evil. And to explain how evil reached men today, materializes the evil so that mankind, the mythology he creates is extremely complicated, and it is impossible to go into it because there are so many intermediary stages, but it always means a fall of the good, or of the intermediary beings who have good, which are imprisoned in matter, which is radically, ontologically evil, and not only evil, infinite and eternal. And that is why Augustine is also very much preoccupied by the later on as a Catholic Christian by the problem of the transmission of the original fault or original sin. Manichaeism had a very great following in Africa. Montanism, to which Tertullian also belonged, had a following, and it was only through government pressure that these heresies were finally suppressed. Not only government pressure, but also because of, in particular, the writings of Augustine and others like him who combated both Marcionism. Marcionism also influenced Origen, the beginning of Manichaeism. Marcion was a Christian teacher in Asia Minor, again, who posited, because he cannot explain the evil and even the violence of the Old Testament, posits an opposition between a God of the Old Testament and a God of the New Testament who would be good. So you have two absolute principles, again, combating each other. Now, Mani does the same and opposes a God of evil who is in the Old Testament, who expresses himself in various ways in the Old Testament, and a God of who is Father, who expresses himself in the New Testament dispensation. Again, the texts used to prove this are extremely selective, so that even the New Testament is not accepted en bloc. Manichaeism made great use of Paul, but again selecting passages, because Paul is anti-nomian, anti-legal, as he claims. Now, in Africa, this was the great drama which was played out in the 2nd and 3rd century, until the coming of the Vandals. The Vandals, you will remember, entered the history of North Africa in 429. And the manner of the entry is not very clear, but they were certainly, they originated, as you know, from on the shores of the Baltic Sea and moved south, and being propelled by other barbarian or Gothic tribes, they were pushed further south and crossed all Central Europe, Northern Italy, Gaul, into Spain, and finally from Spain crossed over into Africa in 429, apparently called by the governor of Roman Africa, who had been falsely accused and asked for Vandal help against the threat which was stood against him. But the Vandals liked the country and decided to make it their own, to build up their own kingdom. They moved on very rapidly from the Straits of Gibraltar, and in 430 they were besieging Hippo, Augustine's city. During the siege, as you know, Augustine died, and in the same year, 430, Hippo, Augustine's city, fell to the Vandals, and 9 years later Carthage fell. Attempts were made by the Byzantines on two occasions. Two important expeditions were sent to recover Carthage, but they failed. But under Justinian, an attempt was made under Belisarius, commanded by Belisarius, and this succeeded. It succeeded for the very good reason, although Belisarius's forces were not too great, but he was assisted by, first of all, the welcome he got from the local population, but also by the fact that the Vandal king at the time, Gelimer, was engaged with his entire fleet in putting down a rebellion in Sardinia. So there was nobody to defend Carthage, and Carthage fell very easily. And although combat went on for about 2 years, but finally Vandal resistance was dominated, and King Gelimer, the last king of the Vandals, was taken to Jerusalem, to Constantinople, and led in triumph through the city, a triumph in the traditional Roman way. Under the Vandal period, the Christian church was under attack almost all the time, continually. The fact of persecution, Vandal persecution of Catholic Christianity, was continuous. The Vandals themselves were Christians, but they were Arian Christians. That is to say, they did not accept the Council of Nicaea. They had been converted by a Gothic bishop, Ulfila, who also translated the Bible into ancient Gothic, and they were very much attached to their religion. The head of the Vandal host, who called himself King of the Vandals and the Alans, was Gaiseric, or Genseric, both names are used. And although historians have been prone until recently to say that the Christian persecution, the persecution of Christians, was the result of the Christians reacting to confiscation of lands, of private and church property. But the latest research, the church in particular, brings it out very clearly, that the persecutions predated the confiscations of land. Already when Hippo fell, Hippo is the modern Borna, or Annaba, as it is called in Arabic, and that is part of Numidia. That belonged to the Numidian province. But already when Numidia was conquered, and part of Proconsularis, that is the present-day Tunisia, was conquered, that religious persecution was already underway. And it is typical of the Vandals that they had this religious fanaticism, and that for them it was inconceivable to establish Vandal rule without obtaining religious conformity. The two things went together, and this led to the persecution of Catholic Christians. When the Vandals conquered Carthage and established their realm, they divided the country. The upper part, the more Romanized part of the country, was attributed to the Vandal chieftains, cut up. All the estates of the church and of the nobles were confiscated and distributed it among the Vandal chieftains. The southern Tunisia that is the Bisacena, was kept by the king as royal demesne, under his direct control. And it was necessary, the Vandals who crossed over the Straits of Gibraltar, apparently, according to the reports given at the time, they were in all, men, women and children, 80,000. So that is not a very great number for such a huge expanse of country. And the whole country was controlled by them. And in order to maintain themselves, they had to be on the military qui-vive all the time. And to maintain an army and to pay for mercenaries, they would be Berber mercenaries also helping the Vandal military class, needs a lot of financial support. And that is why the Vandals had to impose a very stiff taxation policy on the country, which made them very unpopular. Now, what the Vandal occupation did was to unite really all Christian strands. I forgot to mention before that in the 4th century, which is the Christian century, that is Constantine, 312 is the Edict of Tolerance, and this it was a great event for the Christian church, but it also brought with it certain unforeseen problems. The persecution, the great persecution under Diocletian had created immense problems for the church, not only in the way of martyrs for the church and a disruption of church organization, but the pressure of persecution had produced a number of apostasies or semi-apostasies. By semi-apostasies, I mean those people who, to escape penal proceedings, presented certificates showing that they had sacrificed to the gods. They were false, forged, or documents drawn up by the pagan slaves, etc. They were called libellatici. But others had actually apostatized out of fear, pressure at the period. Now, with the freedom of the church, the problem came up, how to deal with all these people who really never wanted to apostatize, but who in fact did apostatize, and who asked to be reconciled when it was possible to be a Christian without being proceeded against by law. And you had the church, the hierarchy, being very open to reconciling these people on penance, on a certain penance. But, and this is typical of Africa again, and of its psychology, if you like, its extremist and propensity for fanatical solutions. You had a rigorist branch which refused to reconcile even under penitence, that is to keep excommunicated until death because of a word which came into being at the period is the word traitor. Now, the etymology of the word traitor is from the Latin tradere and traditore. Now, this means handing over, because in the Great Persecution and also before in the persecution of Decian in the mid-3rd century, the church leaders and lay and Christians were obliged to hand over the sacred scriptures. Now, in North Africa, Christians had a very great reverence for the text of scripture. So to hand over the holy scriptures was seen as, this is the word of God, you hand it over to a pagan to be, this was considered a very great offense, which does not admit of reconciliation. That is one of the great problems, the problem of those who had been traditores, had handed over the scriptures. Another problem is, again, this illustrates the psychology of the African Christian. A baptism, the question, the problem of the validity of baptism, of a baptism which was administered by either a heretic or a schismatic. Is it valid? Now, you had two branches. You had mainstream, not necessarily numerical, mainstream Christianity represented by the Bishop of Carthage and a number of bishops, was that the sacraments, the doctrine was developed by Saint Augustine, because he had to, he has a number of works. The answer given by the episcopate, the Catholic episcopate, was that the sacraments are acts of Christ. So whether given by a heretic or a Catholic Christian, it was still a baptism, and you accepted the validity. It still meant that there was a process of reconciliation, but the sacrament was valid. But the extreme wing did not accept this, and they were led by a bishop who had, from this period, there was disagreement, and you had a conflict which was brought to Rome also, and which led, I don't go into details, but which led to the creation of two parallel jurisdictions. One, a Catholic jurisdiction, a Catholic Bishop of Carthage, and a dissenting Bishop of Carthage. The most famous, he was the second in this series, was called Donatus. And that is why, and that brought into being what is known as the Donatist Church. Now, the problem, the origin of the dispute is certainly theological and disciplinary in the church. Now, the question is that there are historians who claim that the problem was not theological, but that it was social and economic. To me, it is clear that the origin of the dispute is theological, but there are non-theological factors which also influence. One is a certain rivalry, you always have this rivalry, between the Church of Carthage, that is the church in Proconsularis, which is the more Romanized part, and the Numidian bishops. This is illustrated in an important incident right at the beginning of the Donatist controversy. It had been, the Bishop of Carthage was a kind of patriarch for North Africa. He was a bishop equal, primus inter pares, but he was the senior bishop. But the Bishop of Carthage was traditionally, or by custom, consecrated by a Numidian bishop. Now, when the bishop at the Peace of the Church died and a new bishop was elected in the person of Cecilianus, he was elected by the clergy of Carthage, which was perfectly normal, and the bishops of the Carthaginian province consecrated him. And when the new Numidian bishops came, they were disappointed and disputed the election. So you have here one of the non-theological factors operating, rivalry between two provinces. But more than that, in the development of the controversy shows that the more Romanized, more urbanized, more progressive, more cosmopolitan section of the population was Catholic Christianity, but the artisan, the provincial, the population, the popolino in the cities and in the country were Donatist. The Donatist Church was a popular, but in the populist sense, phenomenon. And this is very remarkable. And that is why you have Donatism was able to maintain itself for a very long time and divided the church. So to come back to the freedom of the church. The freedom of the church with Constantine in 312 brought many great opportunities for church development, but it also opened the way for interior divisions. And in Africa, this was very important because this divide between Catholic Christianity and Donatism, the Donatist church, lasted all through the period until the Arab invasions. And it weakened, to this extent, the Christian community. So Constantine's conversion had both a positive and a negative aspect, in fact, for North African history. Now, to conclude very quickly, Christian development in the period Constantine. Positively, you have a great development of Christian writing, a number of very great authors. You have a great development in church building, architecture, great development in art. You also have great prosperity. The period of greatest prosperity was probably the 3rd century, but right up to the Vandal period, North Africa was very prosperous economically, exporting grain to Rome and later to Constantinople, olives and oil. All Numidia was, the authors say, a forest of olive trees, the whole area. Pottery was exported. Ordinary pottery, household pottery in immense quantities, it seems. The Vandal period was not a period only of destruction. Vandal period, in the cities you had a situation of persecution or latent persecution, but in the country areas you still have, and archaeology has revealed this, you still had church building in the country areas, but the quality is far inferior to what it was before. Then you have the Byzantine period, about which I haven't spoken very much, but in the Byzantine period you have a reorganization of the church, you have fewer bishops, you have a re-establishment, a program of restoration of churches, a great building program, and also a missionary program, which was put in motion thanks to the ideology of Justinian. Justinian wanted to restore Roman greatness, but Justinian was also a very religious man, and for him to reestablish Rome without establishing religious truth, religious peace, it was inconceivable. And what you see in North Africa today, in the great cities which have survived, and also in the cities and the provincial towns of Numidia, present-day Algeria, is largely the product of Justinian's building program. Some of it is described in a work by Procopius, who is the great historian of the Vandal Wars, as he is also of the Gothic Wars. He gives a description of Justinian's building program. Now, if you go to places like Sabrata and Leptismania in Cyrenaica, and as far down as Galames in the Fezzan, you will find Justinian's churches. Churches built under Justinian or in the Byzantine period until the coming of the Arabs in the 7th century. The same thing in places like Timgad, which has remarkable remains. And the churches are of the Byzantine period. It is well established today. Even as far as Morocco, Lixus and Volubilis, you have churches built during this period. Christianity was, at the time of the Arab invasions, in full expansion. But did not have enough time to have in the Berber areas to eradicate itself sufficiently to resist. But Berber Christianity survived, let alone coastal Christianity survived for very late. There is evidence up to the 12th century of Berber Christianity. And in Morocco, one can still see vestiges, not simply in the ruins of Volubilis, etc., but in the tattooing of the Berber tribes. The crosses you will find on the tattoo, very clearly Christian origins in the tattooing, and on Berber carpets, the rugs they make. You also have certain nomenclatures of tribes which recall a Christian past. Beni Injil, for example, sons of the gospel. But Christianity disappeared. Weakened by interior division, weakened by the continual destruction operated by the nomadic tribes who destroyed the economy and provoked emigration from North African countries and from the cultivated areas in the valleys of Algeria.
Thank you very, very much, Monsignor. Does anybody have any questions? I'll have to give you the microphone.
Is there any basis for the tradition that Hannibal was born in Malta?
Well, that is not the period which I had in my... but certainly the Malta was within the orbit of Carthage. And as regards my period, it is historically recorded that Belisarius stopped in Malta on his way to Carthage. Now, there are other interesting connections. The language situation, Punic survived in North Africa for a very long time. It is possible that Punic did survive in Malta for longer than one thinks, but we have no proof of it because we have no documentary record. But we have documentary record of the survival of the Punic language in North Africa, at least up to the 5th century, because Augustine in the 5th century calls upon a Punic-speaking interpreter to help him talk to the people in provincial towns. So the survival of Punic in Malta is a possibility.
Did the Donatist Church spread outside North Africa?
No. The Donatist, it's a purely North African phenomenon. Purely, it was not explored. They did try to establish themselves in Rome, but they never received a hearing. They were examined. A number of councils were called by Constantine, both in Gaul, in Rome, first of all, and the decision went against Donatus, and they appealed again to Constantine, and Constantine called a new council in Gaul, in Arles, precisely because Gaul had not been subjected to persecution in the Great Persecution, and the bishops were considered neutral. But the decision went against Donatus again. And although they appealed to the empire, they did not, reject the empire, but they never achieved credibility outside of Africa.
Any other questions? Right, well, I'd just like to say thank you very, very much for an extremely interesting talk this evening. Certainly, for those of us who are in Libya this September, the Christian element was, for myself, I speak for myself certainly, quite a surprise. I wasn't sort of thinking that, I didn't think that there would be so much evidence. So it was interesting to link what we saw from the archaeological point of view with what you were saying this evening. I think it's made it very much come alive for us this evening. Thank you very, very much.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Archaeological Society entitled North Africa in Later Antiquity by Monsignor George Mifsud Montanaro.